You saw a PowerPoint presentation yesterday from Brother Glendon. Done an excellent job on the previous chapter that we're going to be studying today. I don't have anything quite as fancy, but hopefully there's a little bit of information here that we can find to discuss in these verses. As we continue our study in the book of Daniel, we're reminded that Daniel instructed Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, verse 28, that there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Daniel was the only one to correctly provide the explanation of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel further reminds the king in 27th verse of that same chapter that the secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king. And the king confirms that the God of Daniel is one who hath revealed the things of the dream, as we see in 47 of chapter 2. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret to me. The king was very well convinced that Daniel was indeed the one with what the king might have seen as a special connection with the Creator, because no one else in Babylon could explain the king's dream. This special connection had put Daniel into a unique position of ruler over all the province and allowed him to sit in the gate of the king. Daniel chapter 3 is an inspiring record of men who chose the narrow way and who were prepared to follow it wherever it led. Men who went forward from strength to strength, building for the future with purpose and determination upon a firm basis of light and reality. Nebuchadnezzar, the personification of human pride and power, sets up an image of gold that all are commanded to worship. All through history, it has been the same image in various forms, and it is the same today. As we begin chapter 3, it is evident that Nebuchadnezzar put the dream into action and made an image of gold. No timetable is mentioned in the construction of this image, but it was likely soon after the interpretation of the dream. As written in the first verse, the image of gold would have been easily recognized at the height of 60 cubits, some 90 to maybe over 100 feet, and 6 cubits wide, or about 10 feet in diameter. This is symbolic of the image of man. 6 is the number of man, and the measure of his dominion on earth. Even though Nebuchadnezzar was told by Daniel there would be an inferior kingdom after him, the king attempts to defeat divine intervention by constructing a giant golden image. This was representative of Babylon in his dream. As we continue in verses 2 and 3, mentions the variety of officials that were called to the dedication of the pagan image. Babylon was extremely wealthy and organized, as indicated by all the managing positions that were listed, not unlike many modern-day governments in the world and the papacy as well. This dedication was no doubt a tremendous undertaking with a high level of importance. Notice it was the king that has set up the image. The God of Daniel did not command that an image be constructed for worship. The mind of the flesh was in full bloom concerning Nebuchadnezzar's thoughts and actions. The command was given by King Nebuchadnezzar in verses 4 and 5. Then an herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Again, we see that the number of musical instruments used were 6, and that is the number of the flesh. The music of Babylon is designed to gratify the flesh. The constant repetition of the musical instruments, as seen in verses 5, 7, 10, and 15, emphasizes the importance that was attached to this form of service. It was emotional, religion stimulated by rousing music. As the command was set forth to worship the image when they heard the music, the falling down was an act of complete submission to the fleshly image. This complete submission was to be commenced within the hour that the music was heard, or the consequences were a fiery death. The Babylonians worshiped fire. To them, a fiery death was utter destruction, burned into ashes. As Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego maintained their faith unto Yahweh and refused to bow to the image, we are told that certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. This would likely have been a welcomed opportunity for the Chaldeans to seek a means of bringing the downfall of the three Israelites that were elevated to positions of eminence above them. Daniel himself does not appear at this crisis when his three companions were cast into the fiery furnace. Apparently he was elsewhere, but 70 years further he has his own trial in the pit of lions, which we'll hear about more later this week. The matter of the three Israelites disobeying the king's command was brought forth to Nebuchadnezzar, and he questioned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego if it were true. All knowing what the consequences were for not obeying the commandment, certain death in the burning fiery furnace. They refused to submit to the king's law. Worship of the golden image was virtually an acknowledgement that the dynasty of Nebuchadnezzar should continue through the ages. To refuse to submit to this implied the attitude of a traitor towards the king and his realm. It is likely that Nebuchadnezzar feared the defiant Jews, knowing that God was with them, and recognizing that if they successfully defied his law, the prophecy of the dream image must prevail. In verse 14, the margin renders, "Is it on purpose?" Such a rendition is supported by Jacinius. The king wanted to know if their action was an oversight or deliberate. He gave them an opportunity to retract and excuse themselves from the mistake. After all, he honored their God, so they should honor his. In verse 15, he gave them another opportunity to reconsider. Nebuchadnezzar could not understand how a God could deliver the three Jews out of his hands. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were totally committed in their faith, just like David was against Goliath and so many others throughout Scripture. The three realized there would be other kingdoms to rule after Babylon. All of the kingdoms were hanging on to the pagan godheads. The truth was always there and solid as a rock. In Daniel 3, verse 19, it says, "Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1/7 times more than it was wont to be heated." King Nebuchadnezzar had immediately changed his visage. In Strong's, that word says anaph, which probably meant his nose or nostrils flaring, rapid breathing, in anger. In Nebuchadnezzar's mind, he would not be made a fool. He commanded that they heat the furnace to a level that would destroy anyone. Why heat the furnace to such intensity? Because Nebuchadnezzar had received such evidence of the power of the God of the Hebrews that he is somewhat not sure of this outcome. By heating the fire, he increased the power of the God of fire in his mind, that even the Hebrews' God could not save anyone that was thrust into the furnace. Three Jews were bound and cast into the midst of the fiery furnace, completely clothed. The word coats is sarvelen, which signifies to cover. In fact, the way they were dressed, in large loose trousers, tunics, and enveloping mantles, were similar to Babylonian clothing. This normally would have made them vulnerable to fire. But there is a more significant feature, a type. All true saints are clothed. They have to put on Christ, as mentioned in Galatians 3:27, and seek to keep their garments unspotted from the world, as in James 1:27. Figuratively, they were clothed with Christ, and Christ protected them from the fiery trial in which they were placed. The king could not believe his eyes. The three were not harmed, and yet a fourth one with them that appeared like the Son of God. Nebuchadnezzar the fourth was like an angelic form, which in the future, the antitypical Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler of Babylon the Great, will see one like unto the Son of Elohim in the company of the glorified elect. Once again, the king finds himself in a position to acknowledge the supremacy of the Most High God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. As we'll see in chapter 4, it says, "The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men." In chapter 3, verse 27, it says, "These men upon whose bodies the fire had no power." The roller coaster moods of the pagan rulers concerning Yahweh's chosen people indicate that the flesh is always active. As we remember Pharaoh's reaction to the miracles performed through Moses, Pharaoh was always changing his mind whether or not to let God's chosen people leave Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar will soon learn a lesson of the ultimate power from the God of Daniel. If we look back to Luke 21, there was a verse from the Mount Olivet prophecy that says, "There shall not an hair of your head perish." This is likewise connected to our study in this chapter of Daniel. When walking in the mind of the Spirit, we are covered with Christ and completely protected from the trials of fire. This may pose the question, are we prepared to be tried with fires of the furnace? Is our faith strong enough to carry us through the toughest times in our walk towards Zion? King Nebuchadnezzar was having to humble himself before the entire assembly after witnessing the miraculous outcome of the three Hebrews. The king's word was now changed. He made a decree that every people, nation, and language that speaks against the God of the Hebrews shall be cut in pieces, and their homes shall be made a dunghill. Punishment that Nebuchadnezzar threatened those who blaspheme was common to those times. Ancient inscriptions depict captives being drawn and quartered. Christ used similar terms in describing the condemnation that shall be meted out to those rejected at the judgment, although not being cut in two. But having broken the covenant, the fate of the covenant victim will become theirs in that they will be rejected. In the last verse of the chapter, it shows the promotion of the fearless and faithful Israelites to be a witness for any who, willing to make themselves a sacrifice to Yahweh, will never lack a reward.
Now we can open the class for any comments that want to be made related to this chapter. Brother Seth?
I want to take a look at the faith of the three men, and especially something that was in my Bible. Now, with the many printed Bibles that we have, there are often notes printed alongside with them, just commentary on the verses. And because they come from different sources, their quality is going to vary. Sometimes these notes are right on the mark, especially if they're going to talk about archaeology or something like that. And then other times where these notes are going to be way off. For example, I wouldn't trust any of the notes that are written for the book of Revelation. But for this chapter, there was a note printed in my Bible which is absolutely spot on, and it has to do with the phrase, "but if not." It's one of the things that the three men were telling Nebuchadnezzar. Yes, our God could save us from this fire, O king, but if not. Now, wait a second. They are saying they can be delivered from the fire, but they're saying these three words. Is that doubt that we're hearing? That's not doubt. That's reality. God can do anything. He can save them from the fire. But the thing is, because God's plan is often above our heads and we can't always understand what he has in mind, it may not be in his purpose to do something. It may not have been in God's purpose to save these three men. Let's think for a moment about Jesus Christ, our Master. The time is coming for his sacrifice, for his death, as it was written in the prophecy, and he is frightened. He is praying to his Father, "If it be your will, remove this cup from me," and he knew God could do it. Sometime after this, he would tell his disciples, "Don't you realize I could pray to my Father, he could send legion upon legion of angels to help me." But he adds to that, "How would the scriptures be fulfilled if that was to happen?" And so in his prayer he concluded, "Not my will, but thine be done." The reality. God could save Jesus. Jesus had to die, so Jesus had to carry it out. And these three men knew that. God could save us from this fire, but what if we were supposed to die, as an example, or something else like that? So let's return to what they're saying to him. Yes, God could save us from the fire. But if not, if for some reason it is our lot to die in this fire, king, even if we die, we still are not going to bow down in front of this image. Now we see that due to God's mercy in this chosen case, they were saved. They weren't expecting to be saved, though. They could very well have died in the fire, but they still held fast the commitment, "We will not worship this idol." And so when we think about their courage, knowing that they were faced with a situation that may not come to their natural advantage, we have to ask ourselves, do we have that courage?
Brother Burrow?
Nebuchadnezzar is the personification of man. He's the personification of sinful flesh. When we look at the image that he sets up, you know, we read it's 70 cubits and 6 wide. That's 60 cubits, or 6, and the other 6, the number of man. He's setting up man's image, man's worship. He's setting up the things of man, and he's highlighting the things of man. It's no different today. There's no change. There's no difference. We're taught to worship the things of man. We're taught to look at the things of man. In all different ways, in more ways than we realize. The things of the flesh are all around us. You know, I hate to go in and say too much, but when you look at your mailbox, I've had this discussion with some people. When you open your mailbox, there's all kinds of ads trying to teach you to buy something. You know, this nation has been founded on the purchase of things. It's been founded on greed. It's been founded on covetousness. The whole Western civilization is founded on covetousness. The current president thinks we need to spend our way out of a recession. This is the mind of man. It's not the mind of God. And Nebuchadnezzar was symbolizing that. He was bringing this out. And that's the objection that they had. you can't worship the things of man. You can't lust after the things of man. You can't go after the things of man. You need to put the things of God to your heart. That's what you're striving for. That's what God wants. That's behind the law and the prophets. That's behind the things of Christ. Put the things of God first and ignore the things of man.
Brother David, do you have some, David Somerville, do you have something?
Just to go along with what Brother Seth was saying is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said that the God was capable of doing it, but whether he was going to, you know, they couldn't say for sure. And showing their great faith. Well, brought to mind Hebrews 11, verse 35. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might attain a better resurrection. And others had trials of cruel mockings, scourgings, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with a sword. They wandered in sheep's clothes and goat skins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. So, you know, we don't know, you know, some of these people that were not allowed were tested and killed. It might have been more of a test for those around them to make sure that they stayed true. And that's what we're not promised an easy life here. We're actually promised the opposite. We're going to be tried and tested to prove that we have the tried faith, not the gold that shows the glory of man, which Nebuchadnezzar was trying to show in his image. But we're supposed to have the gold that tried faith that shows that we have put God first.
Brother Jim, and then Brother Glennon. Brother Jim, right here.
Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, we're at the third chapter of Daniel, and this is the third time we're introduced to these three men. And it's the third time we're introduced to them in a time of crisis. The three or the four people that we've been discussing, four young Hebrew taken from the land of Israel by Nebuchadnezzar, these four men were the princes, the king's royal seed, the wealthy princes of Judah. When Nebuchadnezzar came in, he didn't destroy the city. This first time, remember there was three captivities. This first captivity, Nebuchadnezzar just came and he skimmed the best off the top. He took the gold from the temple and he took the top young men of the nation, castrated them, brought them to Babylon. For these probably mid-teenage boys, you know, their hope in their land is gone. They're now taken captive over to Babylon, and they are elected to be indoctrinated, special three-year indoctrination by the king to learn the way of the Chaldean, the language, the science, the gods of the land. And they had a three-year indoctrinational period. And as soon as they start this indoctrination, they have a problem, and they refuse to eat the food that they're given. So right there, I mean, they could be beheaded right there, problem over. But we see the approach of these four individuals. They found favor with the head of the eunuch, and he went to the king and requested a trial. They didn't you're wrong, I'm right type of thing. They approached in humility, and they got the audience of the chief of the eunuchs, who got the audience of the king. So their first trial, they succeeded. But it was soon followed by another edict. You're going to all be killed today because the wise men couldn't interpret the dream. And once again, it's like, why is the king's decree so hasty? You know, they didn't confront the king, but they questioned it. The king reasoned with them, and once again, the second time they were spared. And now in today's reading, they're hit with a third trial. Only this one, there's no way of being diplomatic about it. As Brother Mark said, the king said, "Is this done on purpose? Are you defying what I told you to do?" And so we see the trial. Each time you pass the first one, you say, "Phew, got out of that one." And God gives you a second one. And you get out of that, and here's a third one coming right behind it, even harder. And you say, why does God do that to his faithful servants? You pass good. All right, you know, I'm happy with you. You're good guys. No, there's another and more severe trial ahead of them. The lesson to learn is that every tree that bringeth forth fruit, he purges it that it may bring forth more fruit. And that's the message. We're put under trial. We succeed. God is working with us. He was working with them. We had a lecture last night on faith and obedience. Faith is the confident anticipation of things being hoped for. They had that confident anticipation of things being hoped for. Not necessarily that they would be delivered from that trial, as a couple of brethren pointed out. They recognized we may not be delivered, but they had that confident anticipation that the end is worth it. They saw the wise men of Babylon utterly helpless when it came to the interpretation of the dream. They knew there was nothing there. They knew that their God had the answers. Therefore, in comparison, they couldn't serve the God of Babylon. That was nothing. There was nothing in comparison to their God. It's just like Peter said to Christ when the disciples all forsook them, and he said, "Will ye also go away?" And Peter says, "Lord, whither shall we go? We know and are persuaded that thou art the Son of God." You know, what is he going to go? Go back to fishing? Go? What can I do? We know you. That's faith. That's the confident anticipation. And that's what we see in these three men this morning. That faith and obedience that we had that lecture on last night.
Brother Glennon?
I just wanted to go back to that first verse. I think there's a lot in it. The first thing we find in it is Nebuchadnezzar makes an image of gold. The significance of the image, I think, is kind of fresh in our minds because we just had the image in Nebuchadnezzar's dream interpreted to him. But now Nebuchadnezzar makes an image, and it's of gold. Well, what's the significance of the gold? Well, we remember he was told, "You are the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold." And with that fresh on Nebuchadnezzar's mind, he makes this image all of gold. Well, in that last chapter, he didn't have much time to relish in the fact that he was the head of gold, because right after that, Daniel says, "After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and then another, and then another." So Nebuchadnezzar is quickly faced with the idea that his kingdom's not going to last, and that it's actually going to be followed by kingdoms inferior to his. But in this chapter, you see him setting up an image all of gold. And Brother Mark commented on that he was setting up an image that described his dominion as lasting forever. And he wasn't just setting it up so that he could kind of relish in this personal satisfaction that he'd set an image up. He wanted the whole earth to submit to the destiny he was setting forth, rather than the one God had set forth in a destiny of several nations following his. The next thing we find out about it was 60 cubits high and a breadth of 6 cubits. So the dimensions of this image are 60 by 6 by 6. And it's set up in the province of Babylon. So there you have the 666 in Babylon, which of course we have an allusion to in Revelations. And to my knowledge, this is the first time that's introduced, 666 in Babylon. And it also tells us specifically where in Babylon, the plain of Dura. And when you compare that with the image in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, we remember the final destiny of that was the stone cut out of a mountain without hands came and struck the image on its feet and then crushed the image and ground it to powder so that the image was completely destroyed. There was no semblance of it left anymore. And it's interesting that Nebuchadnezzar chooses to put this image in a plain where there's no mountain around. It really seems that he's setting up his own destiny and requiring all to submit to it. And he's challenging God and saying, this is the way I'm going to have it, and there's no alteration, there's no stone, there's no metals that are come after my head of gold, and there's no stone that's going to come and destroy my image. It's going to be everlasting. And that challenge kind of continues throughout the chapter. You see, when he talks to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he's aware of who their God is, who it is they serve, he says, who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? So in other words, he's setting himself up as the ruler and making a pretty bold declaration against God that his destiny, the destiny Nebuchadnezzar had set up, wouldn't be challenged.
Brother Seth? Sid?
Been some real good thoughts brought out this morning by lots of brethren. And I think I can speak for everyone here that we do appreciate all who speak up and make comments. That's a wonderful thing to see the kind of participation we've had. I think Brother Jim cleared something up for me with his comment, because immediately we got talking about the trial and in the fiery furnace, and there was a quotation that came to my mind from 1 Corinthians 3 and 15. And just reading from context a little bit, if any man build upon this foundation, gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide, which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire. And I had a feeling that there was a connection there, and I was unable to really come up with it until Brother Jim made his comment about the escalation, the stages of trial to produce more fruit. And when we think about it, God is not in any sort of need of our work. He can make it happen without it. He is able to raise up children unto Abraham out of stones. And so the work that we do and the trial that often destroys it is meant to spur us on to produce more fruit. And so every man's, he is saved, yet so as by fire, to the point where we realize that it is not our fruit alone that saves us. We are saved by grace and by our realization of that fact. And the other thing that I got to thinking about is, we read about Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego going into the fiery furnace and going through this trial, and we think, oh, it's wonderful, at this point in time, they trotted out this tremendous faith. Where did it come from? How can we face a tremendous trial of our faith and just come up with it out of the blue? We cannot. We realize that as we watch Daniel and his companions being taken captive and the trials that they went through, that they maintained faith as a habit. They recognize the presence of God as a habit. And that's something that proves invaluable to us. If we can make trusting in God, recognition of His presence, depending upon Him in faith, in our day-to-day lives, in things that we're inclined to think God would have no interest in, but put our trust in Him. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. And faith becomes a habit. And then when the real fire comes and our faith is put to severe trial, we have something to to draw on. We have a history of dependence and realization and synergy with God, rather than just trying to find faith all of a sudden in the middle of nowhere.
We have more for one time for one comment, and I believe there was a hand. I don't want to miss anybody that had their hand up first. Anybody? Brother David? And Brother Burr, I'll let you go after.
I'd like to thank Brother Mark for his 50-minute exposition and also the excellent comments you've heard. There's a wonderful proverb which even the world has adopted, whoso diggeth a pit, he shall fall into it. We obviously have later on in the book of Daniel, which we will look at later in the week, God willing, a perfect example of that with Daniel in the lion's den. But we even have it here in type. Nebuchadnezzar, who, as we've said, is the epitome of the symbol of the kingdom of men, created this fiery furnace and heated it seven times. Such was the anger and his antipathy to all that is good and right and true and godly, which of course has been perfectly followed through in the latter day Babylon. But as he is the head of gold and the first of the four significant dominions of the kingdom of men, the Babylonians, Medo-Persians, Greeks, and Romans, as he was the first, he became sort of synonymous with all that followed. And being sort of Mediterranean and European and Euphratean, in this instance, he sort of established a position whereby his kingdom of men, and as it would follow, would be the arena, if you like, of where the the seven thunders would be uttered against the kingdom of men as it stands, as the image stands, headed by Russia in its first installment, and also with the hour's war with the beast. This arena of Europe, particularly Europe, but also the Euphratean area, will become this furnace of fire, heated seven times by the seven thunders. And so we see that the kingdom of men, whilst sort of manifesting itself against the sons of God, will ultimately be the very recipients of the furnace of fire that they helped to create.
Apparently, that was an impression. We had an hour, but we have an hour and 15 minutes, so we have time. Brother Burr? If anybody else wants to make comments, please.
As Brother Sid's ideas were spurred from Brother Jim's comments, mine come from something that Brother Sid said, and he talked about faith. And in this chapter of Daniel, there is the language of faith. Because we read, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. That's the language of faith. And that brings to mind a New Testament saying that we all know very well, which is the language of faith. Not thy, not my will, but thy will be done.
Brother Glendon?
These three men drew much of their strength, I'm sure, from the Old Testament writings before them, one of which was Deuteronomy. And in that law that I'm sure they were taught as children, Deuteronomy 4:24 says, "You don't make any graven images or any carved images to worship." And it finishes with the expression, "I am a consuming fire, for I, your God, am a consuming fire." And it's interesting that happens to be in the same command that was being violated here by Nebuchadnezzar, and on pain of being thrown into a fire. So the choice for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was whether to suffer the heat of Nebuchadnezzar's fire or to face their God, who was a consuming fire. And I think with that before him, the choice was pretty clear that Nebuchadnezzar's fire was much less powerful than their God. And they were so resolute in that, they were so firmly founded in their faith for God and His power, that they were willing, in the midst of a plain covered with submissive individuals to this image, they were, you know, had the strength to stand. You know, they must have looked like three lonely trees out on that sea of people all bowing down. And because of that boldness in their faith, they showed all those people, after walking through the furnace, they showed all those very princes of the whole world who the true God was. So Nebuchadnezzar's plan for total submission to his will by all the earth ended up in a total submission to God's will by all the earth. It wasn't just a private proclamation, such as the dream may have been with Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. Rather, it was forcibly a worldwide realization that Daniel's God and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God was the true God.
Brother Curtis, and then Brother David.
One of the things Mark kind of touched on a little bit is part of this was being separate, a separate people. They wasn't supposed to worship the gods of other countries and stuff like that. Anyway, they were supposed to be a separate people. And Brother Glendon brought out how it's really it was kind of a little bit of a national deal. We're trying to get support for their nation. And so today we might want to look and see what corresponds to that for us, or what would be close to that. And Joel probably knows as well as I do what we do in the school system. And we, as a country of the United States, I don't know what it is in other countries, but in the United States, every school child is supposed to stand up, face the flag, put their hand over their heart, and say the Pledge of Allegiance. And then in Texas, it's even worse. We had to say the Pledge of the Texas to the Texas flag too. I think we're pretty unique there. We have a Texas pledge. I'm not sure about why we do that, but that's what they do. So this is done in the school systems everywhere. I'm not sure about businesses what they do. But this is what they do, and it's really worshiping the flag. It's worshiping your country, just like here with the image of Nebuchadnezzar. Of course, we are separate. We don't stand up and worship the flag, and we don't say the Pledge of Allegiance. But our country is allowing us to do that at this time. But there seems to be, to me, since I've been teaching for 20 years, in the last 6 or 7 years, the pressure to stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance has greatly increased. In fact, we didn't do it in our school up until probably the last 5 years. So that's the great pressure being put on by our government to basically worship our flag.
Brother David Van Pelt, and then Brother Sid, and then Brother Lee. That's three.
Brethren and sisters, in reading this third chapter of Daniel and seeing the rebellion and the resistance that's in Nebuchadnezzar in setting up this image which was wholly of gold, he was trying to usurp God's authority and what God had spoken. He thought his decree would outstrip or best the decrees made by heaven, not knowing the God of Israel, not knowing that he rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. That brings to mind the rebellion that was in Pharaoh, whom God had raised up to show forth his power in him. Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him?" Well, he shortly found out in the terrific plagues that came upon Egypt. He was forced, finally, to allow Israel to go free out of Egypt, a nation of serfs, but they were God's people. And what God has spoken, He will perform. And it was determined long before that Pharaoh sat on the throne that Israel would come forth. The next example we see is that of Goliath, who defied the armies of Israel. And he is smitten with the stone in his forehead, and he falls to the ground, and David slays him with his own sword. Notice that David didn't put trust in the armor that at first Saul had offered him. I cannot go with these. I have not proved them. He went to him with a sling and stones in his shepherd's bag, selecting one. His total faith was in God, the same God that delivered me out of the paw of the lion, or the bear. The lion and the bear shall deliver me from this Philistine. So the Philistines soon knew who Yahweh was. The next example we see is seen in Rabshakeh. And we realize that 185,000 lay slain after that incident. He had said, in effect, "Who is the Lord? Are not your God, is not your God like all the gods of the nations?" And he had overcome them and had come up to the heights of Jerusalem. And he esteemed God as not any more powerful than any of they. And they were nothing but idols, the work of men's hands. The world will shortly find out who Yahweh is. Right now, they walk in rebellion and sedition against Him, against His commands, against His laws, against every visage of God. They don't want anything to do with Him. They deny His existence. They are atheos. The people are without God in the world. They're in total darkness. But they shall shortly know. They shall realize who Yahweh is. And they shall know that He has loved those that are His elect, those that have been called, the 144,000. So we need to be strengthened in this time of trial, knowing not what we may have to face before the return of Christ, but whatever comes, we should hold fast, knowing the power of our God, who is indeed a consuming fire.
Brother Sid.
Because the time is short here, I'll try and keep this short. And there's been a lot of very appropriate comments tying Nebuchadnezzar and his image and his kingdom to the kingdoms of men and to the way in which the Chaldean dynasty exerted power and control over their fellow nations. But I think it is very important for us to recognize that Nebuchadnezzar was an individual. And therefore, we can also take this lesson down to an individual lesson. Because sitting in this tabernacle is a whole package of little Nebuchadnezzars, each building our own image, because the flesh within us longs to control our own life and would like to have a little control of other people's lives too, be it in taking vengeance or simply in having some measure of control over someone else. And we have an elaborate system within the kingdoms of men that caters to that individual image building, and it's called the legal system. And the legal system allows me to exert a little bit of control over you. And in so using that system, or not using that system, we can, as individuals, become builders of little images in defiance of the Word of God. And so we have to watch. Not only is Nebuchadnezzar representative of them, that is, the system, the nations, the kingdoms of men, the papal system and whatever, it also represents what is inside each and every one of us. And if we don't recognize that within ourselves, we are fooling ourselves, and it's a terribly dangerous state of mind.
Last comment, Brother Lee.
Actually, it's a question, and not sure if there's if I'm trying to read more into this than what there really is. But why, with these three men and their greatest trial, why were they referred to in the biblical record with their Babylonian name rather than their Hebraic name?
If anybody has a quick answer, what do we think they were referred to by their Babylonian name and not by the Hebrew name? Brother Matthew? Brother Philip?
I'm just going to sort of like venture a comment, and I think it might be linked to the comment that Brother Curtis made reference to yesterday, that in that particular period of time, you know, chapter 2 to chapter 7, we're talking about the times of the Gentiles, and maybe because they're using the Gentile names, it might indicate that that it was in that Gentile period, but that's just a quick comment off the top of my head, really.
Thank you.